I wonder if Jay Powell has ever been to a soybean farm. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 31st of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Interest rates and the Federal Reserve, check. The job market, check. Corporate profits, check, check, and check. Our coverage of all of the above coming up. But we are going to start with an eye toward the calendar. Not All Hallows' Eve, but harvest time for millions of farmers in this economy. Our go-to farmer is April Hemmes. Corn and soybeans in Iowa are what she grows. We got her on the phone earlier today. But as happens in this post-pandemic audio production world, first, we had to get her to hit that red record button on her iPhone.
The button is hit. Ready for anything Kai throws at me today.
The beautiful part about coming into the studio with you is you never know what's going to go on. That's all I'm
saying. That's like farming, Kai. Well, you never know what you're going to find outside.
That's a pretty good comeback. Well, let me ask you about farming. As promised, last time we spoke, I said we were going to call you back at harvest time to see how things have been going. So how had things been going?
Well, if you remember, I was whining the last time
because we hadn't had any rain. I do remember that.
And this is one thing farmers do. We lose our crop at least twice every year. So I had half the rain I normally have. And Kai, I am here to tell you, only if you keep this a secret and don't tell USDA, I had a record harvest. I beat my corn yield by 10 bushel an acre, and I beat my soybeans by 5. But
Well, is 10 bushels an acre, is that a lot of a beat? Is that a big beat?
That's huge. That's ginormous in farming terms.
Then how did that happen if you had a drought and everything was terrible?
I don't know. I had rains at the right time is all I can think of. Now, 5 miles north of me, they're 10 bushels less than average.
Wow.
And 10 miles south, same thing. So it's very, very spotty. And you'll find that all over the country with farmers.
Wow, that's wild.
I feel like Goldilocks. Everything was just right for me.
Just right. So with the understanding, I guess, that you sell a lot of your crop in advance, right? What does all this mean for your bottom line?
So last year was the best year I ever had. This one, I thought I'm going to have so much income, but my inputs were all that much higher. I'm not looking to buy a Rolls Royce, like I said once, or a tractor, tractors are more than cars.
I was just going to say, a combine costs you more than a Rolls Royce, I'm sure.
Yes, it sure does. But so those inputs are just that much higher. They've come down a little bit, but they are still impactful to the bottom line.
Right. So again, you sell most of your crop in advance, and I get that. But price volatility has been a thing for you, and it's been a thing for all farmers. Are things steady-ish, or are you just you're taking whatever the market will give you?
Well, taking whatever the market's going to give me. I kind of backed off selling. I didn't sell as much as I usually do because, you know, the weather's wonky all over. That's an official term, too. Wonky.
Yes.
All over the world. And so the carry in the market is really good. So I'll sell some more later. So I'm storing what I can at home and kind of waiting, playing a waiting game.
Right.
For
what's the carry in the market? What does that mean?
The carry in the market means like the price now and what I can sell it for March is higher.
Gotcha.
Means it pays to store.
Gotcha. All right. So let me just venture a little bit far afield here. And I feel safe in doing this with you, number one, because you can roll with anything. But number two, you are a global, you know, participant in the markets, right? You go to conferences, you talk to people in other countries.
I'm headed to China on Friday.
So there you go. So have a safe trip. But let me ask you this.
Thank you.
The planet right now, things are not great globally, right? We got wars.
It's wonky.
We've got tension. It's wonky. That's right.
Oh, my heavens. Yes.
So you as a key participant in American agriculture, what are you thinking about the next, you know, harvest and season to come for you?
Yeah. Well, as farmers, we have to roll with the punches. Mm-hmm. You know, you just keep doing what we're doing. But yeah, I have to tell you, these markets are so volatile, mm-hmm. you know, that it really is hard to plan. And globally, you know, I was just reading an article on Ukraine. We've kind of forgot about mm-hmm. Ukraine since Israel's come into play here. And China, we just, I was at the World Food Prize, which was a phenomenal event, and we signed memorandums to buy for China worth billions. Right. You know, that's encouraging to know they promised to buy things.
So you go to China in a couple of 3 days, and then you come back, and it's mm-hmm. wintertime. And what are you going to do with yourself? What does a farmer do in the wintertime?
Well, we plan. I was just looking today what varieties did the best, because I'll tell my seed guys what I want. And then we call it meeting season. So It's always busy. I have to get my financial stuff in order for the banker and go in and beg for more money for next year so he lets me farm. So we do all that and then figure out the tax situation.
Never a dull moment. April Hemmes, she's our corn and soybean farmer in Middle Iowa.
Good to talk to you.
Corn and soybean futures today, as it happens, both up something less than 0.5% apiece. Stocks did a little bit better. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Question the Federal Reserve's been wrestling with, lo, these many months and years, and its meeting that wraps up tomorrow, interest rates and what to do with them, isn't only a challenge for the American Central Bank. We got some news from the Bank of Japan today along those lines. It's going to ease up on what it calls its yield curve control policy, basically a limit on interest rates that the BOJ has been enforcing since 2016. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains, number one, how it works, and number two, whether something similar might ever happen here.
Japan's government issues short-term and long-term debt, just like our Treasury Department does. You can get 2- and 5-year bonds, or 10- to 30-year ones. And until recently, the Bank of Japan was trying to keep the interest rates on all of those low.
To increase aggregate demand, consumption, capital spending, right?
That's Sayuri Shirai, an economics professor at Keio University in Tokyo and a former board member of the Bank of Japan. Shirai says the central bank keeps a lid on interest rates by buying bonds. That pushes their prices up and their yields down. For instance, if the BOJ thinks interest rates are getting too high,
the Bank of Japan will come in and they purchase an unlimited amount of Japanese government bonds.
In the U.S., the Federal Reserve does have a lot of influence over very short-term bond yields. But long-term ones, like 5 or 10 or 30-year, those yields are determined by supply and demand in the bond market.
The market's expectation of economic outcomes, the market's expectation of inflation.
That's Tim Dewey, an economics professor at the University of Oregon. He says there's been discussion about the Fed exerting more control over long-term yields. Early in the pandemic, when short-term bond yields were already low and the economy was shut down, the Fed was looking for tools to support the economy even further.
And one idea was that you could continue to ease monetary policy by basically saying, okay, now we're going to target 1-year rate, we're going to target 5-year rates.
And on until long-term interest rates came down. But once the U.S. economy started booming, the whole yield curve control idea fell by the wayside.
The economy is in a different space than it was prior to the pandemic, and I would be very surprised to see this conversation come back for the U.S.
And now that Japan is loosening its grip on its own long-term bond yields, yield curve control could be on its way out there, too. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
As we descend slowly but surely deeper into the holiday shopping season, how willing consumers are to part with parts of their paychecks is getting more attention. And as the collective mood of those consumers gets more hesitant, attention is being paid to that discretionary spending, in particular for us right now on the e-commerce platform Etsy. It did have a bit of a heyday selling crafts and whatnot during the pandemic, but that has changed as we've started spending more on services and experiences. With the company's quarterly results coming in tomorrow, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall looked into what might be in store for this specialized online marketplace.
The resilience of the consumer after all the post-pandemic travel splurging and services spending has its limits. Brittany Steiger is an analyst at Mintel.
Even as prices come down, 71% of consumers are still concerned about rising prices and inflation.
So consumers have pulled back on discretionary spending, says Citi analyst Igal Arunian.
Essentially, everything that's on Etsy is squarely in this discretionary spend bucket.
Plus, with student loan payments resuming this fall, people aren't having to fit that into their budgets, too.
It's those places where the consumer doesn't have to spend.
And then there's holiday spending. Though technically discretionary, it's slightly different, says Claire Tassin with Morning Consult.
There's an enormous amount of pressure to participate in, we'll call it the holiday magic.
She says e-commerce platforms will be relying heavily on discounts to attract shoppers looking for the perfect gift. And Etsy may have an edge in that department.
What we see among young people specifically is much more emphasis on sentimental, entertaining, and sort of humorous gifts, which I do think is a great advantage for a brand like Etsy.
Because Etsy is a known marketplace, says Forrester analyst Sucharita Kadali, for artisan products and
things that are unique, they're special. People may be looking for something very, very specific, like a jute tablecloth.
Though that market is still niche, so it's not going to have the same growth opportunities as, say, Walmart or Amazon. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Speaking of growth opportunities, should you miss something on the air? First of all, we get it. It happens. Life is busy. Second of all, we have a podcast that can meet your needs. Do a little time shifting. Check it out at marketplace.org or the platform of your choice. Here's another calendar item. It is Jobs Week here in the land of business and economics. We'll get private company payrolls from ADP tomorrow. Thursday, we'll bring first-time claims for unemployment benefits. Then Friday, the biggie, the October jobs report. So, a lot of numbers about the American labor market. But as you know, numbers only tell us so much about the realities of working in this economy. So, we got Violet O'Brien back on the phone the other day. She's a notary in Houston. Last we heard from her was February of 2020. And things for her working in this economy are quite a bit different now.
I did a crazy thing. I had a particular client that I've been working with for about 8 years. And we had been circling and talking about having me come to work for them. And I decided to do it. This is a company here in Texas called Lawyers Escrow Company. They're based out of Dallas. And what we do is handle when businesses are bought and sold. At first, I thought I was crazy. Like, why are you changing careers at this? You know, you should be retiring, but I don't have any intentions of doing that. So, but I'm enjoying it. I really am. I'm more involved now with the buyers and the sellers throughout the whole process. I got a phone call from a lady that was buying a restaurant up in Dallas Metroplex, and she was desperate because they had taken her transaction to a real estate title company and they couldn't close it because there's no real estate. She was just buying the business, but not the building. So we took the deal and we closed it. And the seller and the buyer were very good friends. She was like a daughter to him. And, you know, he just was, we're going to make this deal happen, whatever it takes to get her this business. And she's going to take it over. And it was just sweet. If all of our buyers and sellers were that kind and sweet to each other, it would be a totally different world, you know? The money, okay, so it was not quite a lateral move, if you will, but it was going from being a 1099 contractor to getting a W-2. The whole time that I was a mobile notary, notaries don't pay self-employment tax because we're considered public servants. So I wasn't putting money into my Social Security for a long time. But the amount that I will receive has gone up considerably because I've been putting money into it. When I saw that, I thought, oh, this really was a very good idea. I've been working since I was 16. So we're talking over 50 years now. I don't know what it's like not to work. I have friends who are kind of retired, and I think they're bored. This particular job, one of the reasons I took it is because I knew you'll never stop learning. And I find that really exciting. You can check in with me in a few years and see if I still feel the same way.
We will, of course, do that. Violet O'Brien, still notarizing in Houston, Texas. Coming up.
So we just saw this collapse.
Well, that's not great. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 123 points, 0.4%, 33,052 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 61 points, about 0.5%, 12,851. The S&P 500 ticked up 26 points, about 2/3%, 41.93. In the spirit of All Hallows Eve, let's look at some spooky stocks, shall we? Monster Beverage Corporation, maker of Monster Energy drinks, screamed up 0.8%. Spirit Airlines plunged 12.1%. Trial that will determine whether it can merge with JetBlue started today. Look out for that one. Clothing retailer Boohoo, trading under the symbol BOO on UK exchanges, haunted by 1.25% drop, and Bone Biologics Corporation, which develops products aimed at promoting bone regeneration and healing, rattled down 1.2% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Among the reams and reams of data that the Federal Reserve is going to be sifting through as it meets today and tomorrow, the central bank is, after all, very data dependent, as it likes to remind us all the time. One of those pieces of data is how much companies are having to pay for their people, their employees, as measured by something called the Employment Cost Index. We talked about it yesterday a little bit, the all-in cost of workers, salary, benefits, time off, the whole smash. We got the third quarter ECI today, up 1.1% over the past 3 months, just a touch more than expected, 4.3% over the past year. That's higher than the Fed wants it to be. But as Marketplace's Henry Epp reports, labor costs are moving in the right direction, slowly.
Here's why the central bank cares about what businesses are spending on wages and benefits.
If wages are going up, that means that the employer is now paying more, right?
Rucha Vankoudre is a senior economist at Lightcast. She says if employers are paying their employees more,
then they're going to want to make up that profit somewhere. And the way they're going to do that is they're going to increase prices, right?
Then employees demand higher wages to keep up with inflation, and what you have is a wage-price spiral. We heard a lot about this a couple years ago, but now wage growth is cooling off, says Sarah House, senior economist at Wells Fargo.
We're certainly seeing it ease from the frenzied rate that we saw in 2022 and even earlier in 2023.
The main reason? It's a bit easier for employers to find and retain workers, House says. Fewer people are quitting their jobs and more people are entering the labor force. Still, it's not like all of the post-pandemic labor shortages just miraculously resolved.
You still have a historically high share of businesses saying that they're having trouble finding workers.
That's keeping the cost of paying for workers relatively high. It's just not going up as fast as it was a year or so ago. But employees might keep getting raises for a while, says Frank Fiorelli with the payroll company Paychex, thanks to boosts in recent union deals for auto workers and UPS drivers, and a new California law that will raise wages for fast food workers. He says other employers might have to follow suit.
Even in an industry that isn't directly affected on that, they're going to have to react just to make sure that they're competitive and they can get the best and brightest people.
So maybe we all keep getting pay bumps and Jay Powell gets a headache. I'm Henry Amp for Marketplace.
There are 11 states in the nation that let in-home daycare providers bargain collectively, of which California is far and away the biggest. And this year, in a year that's already seen strong gains for organized labor, the union that represents 40,000 of those workers here won big in their fight for better paying benefits. From KQED, Daisy Nguyen has more.
Nancy Harvey opened an in-home daycare in Oakland 20 years ago. She was excited to start a neighborhood preschool, but when she left the corporate world to do that, she wasn't prepared for the low pay and lack of benefits.
I had also worked in the school system, and a retirement plan was essential for anyone that worked a job. And I couldn't understand how this very valuable industry did not have that.
Home-based childcare providers like Harvey are small business owners who work for themselves. Karen Schulman is a policy expert with the National Women's Law Center. She says these small businesses often have slim profit margins.
We always talk about how child care workers are among the lowest paid workers, and these home-based child care workers are particularly low paid, even though they play a really crucial role.
Crucial because they offer a home setting for babies and toddlers who require more individualized care.
Or because they have the flexibility that fewer centers provide.
Home-based childcare providers also offer care for parents who work night or weekend shifts. These families often qualify for subsidies from the state, which then pays the childcare providers. But for years, providers complained the state payments were too low. So they thought, why not form a union to bargain for better pay?
We were organizing our union. From zero.
Patricia Moran runs a daycare from her home in San Jose. She remembers organizing while kids were napping, making calls to other providers to get them involved. And when it came time to negotiate a contract, Moran says bargaining would sometimes go late.
I remember I slept like 2 hours because in my daycare, some parents, they're bringing the children at 5 o'clock in the morning. I need to be ready.
These talks coincided with the start of the pandemic. State Senator Nancy Skinner leads the Legislative Women's Caucus. She says the state had to step up its investments because many daycares permanently closed.
So we just saw this collapse that affected not only families, obviously, and the little kids that really deserve good childcare, but also affected California's employers and our economy.
Nancy Harvey, the home-based provider in Oakland, says the pandemic was really a turning point for her workforce.
People really recognize that fact that, hey, this industry is important. We have set them aside long enough, and we can't do that.
Now, union members have state-funded health care, training, retirement benefits, and more pay. Harvey says having the chance to actually retire is a big change. Many childcare providers used to work into their final days.
I know of several personal stories in which providers literally took care of a child the night before they passed away.
At 61 years old, she now sees a pathway where she herself can retire and retire in dignity. In Oakland, I'm Daisy Nguyen for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today for those among us who are going to have leftover candy around the house for the next week or two, or who might, borrow from whichever children are in the house. First of all, the National Retail Federation says that we have collectively spent more than $2.5 billion on candy this year. But also, And honestly, this is the important part. It's from the website Eater. Milk chocolate candy, assuming it's still wrapped and kept in a cool place, should be good for as much as 10 months. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. Saw this on The Verge today, the economic adage that incentives matter come to life. DoorDash has added a warning to orders on which no tip is included. That warning says, and this is a quote, "Dashers can pick and choose which orders they want to do. Orders that take longer to be accepted by Dashers tend to result in slower delivery." No tip. Dashers don't pick them. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietin, and Janet Wynn, and Olga Oxman. Ellen Rolfe is as well, Virginia K. Smith and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On-Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.